Welcome to Sarah's Bookshelves Live. I'm Sarah of the blog Sarah's Bookshelves. Each week, I'm talking with one bookish guest about two old books they love, two new books they love, one book they don't love, and one new release they're excited about. We're going to get real and sometimes a bit snarky about all things books. If you like the show, I'd really love your support. Spread the word to your reader friends, subscribe to the show, rate and review it wherever you listen to podcasts, or get bonus podcast episodes by supporting the podcast on Patreon. There's a link in the show notes and in my Instagram bio to my Patreon page. Let's get rolling. Hey, everyone. Welcome to a full-length episode of Sarah's Bookshelves Live. I've got a quick announcement today before we get to our guest, and that is starting in June, just like I did last year, the podcast will be moving to a bi-weekly schedule for the summer. My family travels a lot in the summer, and my kids are also out of school, which I guess is no different from right now, but it usually is a different situation, and it's just hard for me to get weekly episodes out in the summer. So I do go bi-weekly, and every bi-weekly episode will be a full-length episode. So we'll just sort of put the mini episodes on hiatus until September. So you'll get weekly episodes through the end of May, and starting at the beginning of June, you'll get an episode every other week, and every episode will be full length. All right, let's get to our guest. Way back in November, and that would be episode 40, I had Bird Level, a literary agent at the United Talent Agency, on the show. He specializes mostly in representing nonfiction authors, and as we talked through the episode, it became really clear that his process and how you represent somebody who writes nonfiction and how you go look for those clients is pretty different than somebody who specializes primarily in fiction. So I knew at that time that I also wanted to have on the show an agent who represents fiction, and that's what we have today. I'm thrilled to welcome Holly Root. She is the founder of Root Literary. Prior to founding Root Literary in 2017, Holly worked at Waxman Level, which was Bird's agency, Trident Media Group, and William Morris. Her clients include number one New York Times bestsellers, Rita winners and nominees, and numerous titles named to the Best Books of the Year list by Publishers Weekly, The Washington Post, NPR, Kirkus, and Amazon. She represents authors of commercial fiction for adults and kids, as well as select nonfiction. And a couple authors that she represents that I'm sure you all know are Christina Lauren, actually, co-author team, Jasmine Guillory, Kelly Harms, and V.E. Schwab. And she's based in L.A. Welcome, Holly.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for being here. I really appreciate it, and I'm excited to get into some behind the scenes on the industry today.
Yeah, absolutely.
Before we get into the industry itself, can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into the literary agency business?
Yeah, so I grew up in Tennessee. I am a Southerner originally. So after I graduated from college, I didn't even know that literary agent was a job, but I got a job working in Christian publishing and was an editor, like a baby editor, and discovered that I was actually really super bad at a significant portion of what actually being an editor is. Like, great at reading books, terrible at reading books 15 times. I get dumber on each read. I'm not a natural rereader. You read these things 17 times. And I would find myself being like, does it actually need to change, or do I just want to find something new? And so as I was sort of working through like, oh, wow, this thing I thought was going to be the thing I was good at is actually something I'm really fundamentally terrible at. We didn't work a lot with agents, but we had access to PW. And reading through the trades, I was like, wait, I think there's a job that's most of the things I'm good at and way fewer of the things that I'm bad at. And so my husband and I moved to New York with just a savings account and a dream. And I highly recommend the turnip truck method, because being too dumb to know where you're not wanted is literally how I got every job thereafter. And well-placed Southerners. I didn't know that they didn't want people who'd gone to colleges that you'd never heard of at William Morris to be agent trainees. So I just like sent in a resume and a cover letter. And the HR person at the time was from Tennessee and was like, oh, yeah, okay, I know what this means, and brought me in. And I was the only little new doobie who was, you know, not coming from like an Ivy League or like had a last name you'd recognize. And so sometimes just not knowing anything is really helpful. And that was my first job sort of on this side of the desk. And then I never looked back. And then from there, I sort of just did a very classic agent, like the old school way of doing it, which is you are somebody's assistant and you learn from watching them. And then you get to start taking baby steps and cutting your teeth. I was an audio agent for a while, which is where you just literally sell audio rights. But that was sort of my path upward. And then eventually I got to a place where I was ready to be just doing my own list full time. And that's around the time that I went over to, at the time, just Waxman Agency, and then Bird became a partner later. And I was there for 10 years. So it's a pretty classic sort of agent journey, as it were. And then I opened my own agency. It'll be 3 years in May. So we're coming right up on that anniversary.
So you mentioned earlier that you discovered being an agent could use all the skills that you were good at and not focus on the skills you weren't good at. What do you think you have to be good at to be a good agent?
I think you have to be a fairly creative, big picture thinker, at least the way I do it. So here's the other thing about agents. There's no one right way to do it. Every author has a style. Every agent has a style. And you tend to find your people in this very woo-woo way, if you'll forgive my moment of Californianess. I did believe this before I moved to California, for the record. You really do find your people. The people who vibe with how you work naturally tend to come to you. And when you're on the phone with an author who's, you know, you're interested in their work, a big part of that call is sort of feeling out each other's approach and style to things. So, you know, for some authors, having somebody who's super editorial and like goes over every manuscript with a fine-tooth comb, and that's like how they view their primary means of representing the client well. And that works great for some authors. That is not my style. I always tell people I won't let them go out with their tags sticking up, you know, like if I see something, I'm gonna say something, but I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to line edit. I'm not going to fix your commas. And the way that I do it, I'm super invested in the process. I'm very curious about the process. I find it fascinating. Figuring out how people find out about books, like the discoverability piece of it is like the hurdle at all times in publishing and never more so than at this exact moment. So what sort of strategies work? How do you reach people where they are? How do you become the thing that they throw in their cart? You know, I very proudly do a lot of Target books, the kind of thing that you would buy at Target. Like when I'm talking to people in my real life and they're like, what kinds of things do you work on? I'm like, well, fun things that you might grab at Target for the weekend. And that really is something that I think about from the very early stages. I do books, you know, for like the people I know, the people I went to college with, the like busy mom who loves to read, and where is she getting books? And so I think about that from the very beginning, and then coming up with that ideal reader for the book, like who is the person we're trying to get, and then thinking about how you do that. And that's everything from, you know, which publishing team might be the best fit to what that publishing team then does and the ways that I can be a partner and what kinds of social media makes sense for my author to spend time on and where they need to conserve their energy. So, you know, we're just, as an agency, I think we're really hands-on through the whole process. And that attention and that sort of like extra set of eyes and brain can be really an asset both for the author and then their publishing team.
Absolutely.
You know, it's one of those funny things where you just kind of never know what the next little connection is going to be. But our job is to kind of have in our head at all times this mental map of tastes and inclinations. And then, you know, you also, as you have experience with people, you see, you know, who's really got their finger on the pulse of how you reach a certain kind of reader and who's really strong in other areas. And so it's all sort of part of the math that goes into putting together that submission list.
I always preach to my listeners, and I do this myself as well, about tracking your reading sources, like not only recommendation sources, but publishers who you have good luck with. People that like the kind of Jasmine Guillory kind of books, what publishers should you be targeting? So like a Berkeley Books comes to mind, which is not a big publisher, right? But for this kind of book, I feel like they've had a couple pretty real good ones lately.
Oh yeah, they punch above their weight for sure. I mean, they were the front of this, you know, like they really, when it was such a fun experience working with, I mean, I love Cindy Huang, who's Jasmine's editor and have worked with her for a long time. But selling Jasmine, that process was really fun because, you know, we sent out this submission and the book did not sell overnight. People sometimes think, you know, oh, for something to be big, it has to be like 10 house auction for $1 million. Most of the books that you know about did not happen that way. Those are the real outliers.
I feel like this one was like an Instagram darling.
Yes. And that was not an accident. There were not necessarily, I mean, there were tracks to sled on. They were the Christina Lauren tracks. And because I had done that, I knew that there was a space there. But again, that process, you know, if you look at like Christina Lauren's first book, Beautiful Bastard, is an extremely different thing than what they're doing now. So they were sort of in the middle of that too. So it wasn't even necessarily apparent from the outside where that was going. But that was my inside track on this as a trend. And they're very different books. They're not in competition. So it wasn't weird for me to be doing both. I think because of them, I had this instinct that there was a reader out there who was reachable in trade and not necessarily reachable in mass market.
And you mean by trade, you mean trade paperbacks.
Yep.
For my listeners, those are the paperbacks you see on like Barnes and Noble's new and paperback table. It's not what you see like in the line at the grocery stores.
Yeah. And the format thing has been a conversation. Like I've been selling romance and romance adjacent books for basically my whole career. I grew up with a mom who was both a romance reader and getting a PhD in neuroscience. So miss me with any arguments that involved like romance not being for smart people.
I think that's kind of becoming a myth that's been busted at this point.
Oh, yeah. You know, in like 2002 or whenever, I think there was still some snobbery. And there always will be. Anything women are into, there'll be snobbery. So I didn't have to unteach myself that in this lovely way that was actually really advantageous when I was starting out. So anyway, it's been part of my product mix for a long time. But we've always sort of had these conversations. For a while, they were doing sort of steamier romance in trade paperback. And then sort of your like classic romance always lived in mass market. And then the steamier romance thing had kind of that. Honestly, that's how we ended up with Christina Lauren being in trade, because that's where a lot of those books lived. But then as that trend kind of waned, it wasn't clear yet what the next thing was going to be and how you could use that format. But so that trade piece of it, I think, was a big part of it. And now, of course, you know, we've got The Wedding Date and The Proposal are out both in trade paperback and in mass market paperback, which makes me really happy.
And y'all, Book of the Month is doing a lot of these rom-coms that are coming out in trade paperback only, they then are doing a hardcover through Book of the Month. So that's the only place you can get a hardcover of some of these books.
Yes. So anyway, I mean, Cindy was an amazing partner in sort of figuring out exactly where this lived, but it took a minute because we would talk. So she read the book. She loved the book. We had a conversation actually in person at a conference about sort of like how I saw it, and I no question makes me happier because I always have a vision. Like there's always a thing when I send something out, I have this mental picture of how it's going to go. And I am willing to be persuaded away from that, to be clear. Like if a publisher comes in and is like, no, it's like this, and they can then, yes, I am happy to board your train too. But I do always have a thing. And that's a big sign for me about whether I want to take something on or not is can I picture what it looks like? Can I picture how we roll it out, how we do it? So I'm sitting there with Cindy and she's like, so talk to me about this. And I'm like, let me tell you. And I get all fired up at this whole thing. And Cindy's like, yes, okay, we are on the same page. Fantastic news. I have to go get everyone else on board. And everyone else in a publishing acquisition situation, if it's very straightforward, you know, book is exactly like three things that also worked in the last year. That is a short conversation. But if you're trying to do something, if you're trying to sort of pull off a new thing, it's going to take longer. God bless Jasmine for just not thinking that I was completely full of it when I kept saying to her, like, things are moving. I promise it's all happening. Do not worry.
Was she like the first one kind of to start this trend?
Sally Thorne's The Hating Game, which is also our client. My colleague Taylor Haggerty, who's frankly the queen of rom-coms, is her agent. So that book, I think if you were going to look for a patient zero, it would probably be around there. I'm always hesitant to sort of out and out name that just because, you know, people are always doing amazing things and you don't want to like overlook something that didn't get the push it deserved. But that definitely was an accelerant. It was gas on the fire.
You said you have the blueprint in your head with how this is going to go. When you took like a Jasmine Guillory to publishers, what was the blueprint you laid out for them as far as how this was going to go?
It sounds really silly because now in hindsight, like it's exactly what we got, but there's no way of me guaranteeing that any of this would work. So it really is me laying out a vision and then recruiting the people who can actually do the thing. So one of the terrible things about being an agent, like I think sometimes authors think that we are all powerful and all knowing. And really all we are is like nudgers, leaners, influencers. Like all we can do is suggest things, but we don't actually write the books. We don't actually like finalize the publishing plan. We have input, but we can't single-handedly do anything. We are reliant on our partners. So it really is a team sport, but we're not running the place. We're drawing them, but we're not running them. Again, it all starts about who the reader is. And I had such a clear sense of who the Jasmine reader was, and that there was this whole sort of like group of people who had not really been invited to sit at the table and to understand that romance had space for, you know, more than what they might have a bad preconceived notion. Because again, like there have been Black women writing romance, there have been Black women writing contemporary romance. That was a piece of it too, that, you know, we wanted to highlight that this was a space where people had too often been sort of pushed out of the center stage and off to the margins. I felt like our issue was one of invitation, not content. Like the content has been there. How do we invite people? And with Jasmine, I felt like there was a really killer opportunity to make people aware that this was for them. And how you do that is in part packaging and in part messaging and also sort of who you send things to. So if you want to tell people, hey, there's a really awesome party that you are welcome at, you don't only tell people who came to the last three parties, right?
Right.
Berkeley cast this amazing wide net where they didn't not send to romance people, but they also reached out much more broadly. But I think a big part of it really was just being that they were so intentional and so smart about reaching out and saying like, hey, romance is a big tent. Like we've got room. If you thought it was only cowboys, or you thought it was only 50 Shades, or you thought it was only whatever, there's room for you here and we'd love to have you.
Was Book of the Month in your sort of blueprint plan, or did they just jump on board independently? Because I feel like they really do a great job of bringing it to mainstream readers that maybe don't read rom-com as much or hadn't before.
I have been thirsty for Book of the Month from day one. I love them. Like, I would love for them to do every single book I ever do ever till the end of time. Amen. I think they're incredible. I love what they do.
Do you have a relationship with them, or do you just hope that they pick your books and check every month to see if it's going to happen?
We do have a relationship with them.
Okay.
I have met and really enjoyed their team. I think they're such an amazing discovery point, and also they have so much power to sort of like shape what people are willing to take a chance on.
Totally.
And, you know, they'll sometimes pick a more literary leaning title that, you know, maybe people would have been like, I don't know. And they'll say, no. Like, if you're going to read one literary novel, this is the one. And I feel like they took that approach and then expanded it to rom-com, which is great. And I think has done a ton to sort of both raise people's willingness to try and also, like I said, extend that invitation, like make people aware that like there's this whole area that you're welcome in. And once you dip a toe in, you know, then you can start exploring. I have a number of friends who started with Christina Lauren and then found like three or four other authors that they liked who often are not necessarily read-alikes at all. But once they kind of got in the pool, they were like, oh, okay, all right. And then they found this other sort of section of the pool that worked for them. And one of the things that I think is so amazing about books is you can totally do that. Like, that's allowed. No one is telling you what to read. You can just follow your joy and read only the things that make you happy and that bring you joy.
Absolutely. Especially right now. Speaking of right now, what are you seeing on the ground with how coronavirus is affecting the publishing industry? And I mean, from the beginning of the pipeline, like we're hearing how it's affecting book sales and how it's disrupting sort of delivery pipelines for new books and how book tours are getting canceled and things like that. But is it affecting the acquisition of books at all?
I would describe this moment in time as deeply cognitively dissonant.
That is a good description.
Yeah. So in the one hand, we've gotten so many emails from like every publisher we've ever sneezed at. Oh, maybe bad reference.
Oh, yes.
It's saying business as usual, open for business, send us your stuff, we're acquiring. And then on the other hand, you know, we're getting emails about our books that are coming out and like, do you move? Do you not move? And we have a lot of books coming out this year.
Have you found most of them are moving or most of them are not moving?
Most of ours are holding, and it's really interesting. I mean, all of it is being done strategically. We had a new Christina Lauren out, The Honey Don't List, right in the middle of like everyone getting shut down nationwide. And there they were, real nice and high on USA Today. So, I mean, I think a lot of it depends on what formats people buy your books in. It depends too on what the book is. First off, like we already had the books. The books were already there. That one was almost too early to there have been a benefit to moving. They were already ready to rock. And honestly, like the bet was that people would need something to take them away. And I think that has borne out, which is great. You know, and as we look at April and May, I think for a lot of publishers, the calculus is based on like how much of a built-in audience do we have versus how much are we relying on things like the indies being able to like press it into their best customers' hands and say, oh, this book is so special and you need it. So I have a book that is definitely beloved of indies and such a like great hand sell. And so I think out of...
That's tough right now.
It is. And out of interest in protecting, you know, those retail partnerships and really wanting things to benefit them, the decision was made to move that one, not wildly, but like just a little deeper into the summer, which seemed like the right choice for that book. I don't have anything where I'm like, oh, we should have called it different. So far, it really does feel like everyone's being incredibly thoughtful.
Do you have a say in whether a publication date gets moved or is that fully the publisher?
If one of my authors was like, this is the hill I want to die on, I would go in blazing. And in most cases, barring it being, we've already shipped the books, you ding dong, we're not doing it.
Sure.
Barring that, you know, I think most publishers would really work to accommodate that. I will say, caveat to that, I do not have like a highly reactive client base, like different authors, different styles, right? Different agents, different styles. If I had an author who like perhaps had a reputation for having big feelings about things and then like a day later having the opposite big feelings about things, then perhaps like a publisher might manage that differently because you don't want to, you can't undo it once you've done it, right? I'm very data driven as an agent. Like I spend a ton of time in BookScan, which is imperfect, but it's what we have.
And y'all, BookScan measures sales. Book sales.
Yes. And it's just print and it doesn't capture every outlet, but it's what we have. And so we use it. And, you know, it's interesting because some of my authors are really up, which is a wild experience to be having. So it really does seem dependent on sort of what the author's footprint is already, how many people they already sort of have. If you have things like Book of the Month,
yep.
You know, we have Emily Henry's Beach Read coming out. So like for something like that, you know, Book of the Month is out now, which functionally gives us this extra pop of people are talking about Beach Read. So when Beach Read comes out, people are going to know about Beach Read. So we're not, you know, that one feels like everything that's shaping beautifully. We're very excited for that book. Everything is going well. Great. So, you know, like it's really a case by case on each book. And then sometimes it's just as simple as like, for some authors, the calculus is like, listen, this is the devil I know. I don't know what it looks like in July. And I don't know that I want to roll the dice. One of the lovely things and the problems with publishing is that like there is no such thing as a tried and true hard and fast. Everything depends. And so you have, you know, people giving like wild hot takes online that are like completely true for them and also completely untrue for anyone else. So, you know, helping our people like sort of sort through that noise and figure out like what really makes sense for them is a big part of our job. But yeah, I mean, it's strange days. This is uncharted territory. You know, we've kind of been all talking about what do you do? What do you submit? What do you not submit? And so I'm going to say two things that sound like they are in conflict, but I don't actually think they are. Not a time for maybes is something we've been saying a lot, but then also take big swings. Not a time for maybes, meaning the thing that you're like, I might could get somebody to see what this is. That I think there's not going to be a lot of room for if a book is on the bubble, if, you know, you had a rocky sales track before all of this started, like no one's sales are going to be better in 2020 than they were in 2019. Like even if you have books that work, it's not going to be like, oh, well, that was the year that, you know, like it's going to be a down year and that's okay. We'll all correct for that. We'll grade on a curve. It'll be fine. And it's also books don't disappear after their first year. So
sure,
at least not the way I like to publish them, they don't. So, you know, we're putting new books into the marketplace that will continue to be impactful for a lot of years to come. But that piece of it, the maybe piece, I think is to encourage us to really dig in and make sure that everything that we're taking out has like a clear path forward. It's weird too, because like I've done a large deal every single week that we've been at home. And those were mostly things that started before the shutdown happened, but I'm also mostly re-upping existing authors. And one thing that does do well in times of turmoil are proven tracks. So if you have somebody whose sales are sort of, we know that this is what they do, like they're in a good position to get a new deal going forward. But when you think about your new stuff and when you think about trying something new or somebody who needs a reboot, no maybes. So that means we have to push our people. We have to be really clear within ourselves about how you position. Is your pitch letter as strong as it can be? Are you making the case for this book to be the thing that can break somebody out of their like coronavirus, like obsessive doom scrolling? And actually transport them for a while. And then also like the book really has to do that because you can pitch anything beautifully, but then like the read has to hold up.
Are you considering debut authors right now?
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, we're always considering debuts.
If the book is the right book, you don't care if it's a debut author, even in this time.
Honestly, debuts are easier to sell in a time like this because, well, okay. The easiest to sell is somebody who's a giant bestseller.
Right.
The second easiest is a debut because debuts are all possibility and publishing loves possibility. Publishing loves nothing more than to invent a bunch of numbers and pretend they're real. So can I tell you one of my favorite numbers publishing invents?
Yes, please.
So if you're someone who like gets a lot of galleys like as a reviewer or a blogger, bookstagrammer, you're probably on Edelweiss, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So on Edelweiss, you know those announced first print numbers?
Uh-huh.
They are 1,000% fake.
What?
They don't have any bearing. I mean, they do have a bearing on reality, but they are literally not at all the number of copies that are being printed. And everyone just knows it.
So how do they decide what fake number to put up there? What's the purpose of the fake number?
The purpose of the fake number is to be an indicator to the reader of how they are positioning the book to go out.
Or like how much marketing they're going to throw behind it.
Yes.
Oh, that's so interesting.
They're using it as a signal. And so if the point of the signal is effective, then it's a good signal. So it's
sure.
It's one of those funny, just like little quirks of publishing. You know, for a lot of books, what they print is not at all an accurate estimation of what they actually sell. Because between audio and e and library, like it can be a really different. And that's one of the funny things, you know, when we're working with book to film stuff, trying to explain to film people that there's no way to know how many people have read something. And they're like, but why? And we're like, well, because libraries and because lending and because like loving a book so much that you shoved it on your friends and they each traded your one copy around and that's five people from one copy. Like, we can't tell you.
Right. All right. Let's get to your book recommendations.
Okay.
As usual, Holly is going to share two old books she loves, two new books she loves. We're going to talk about not liking books. She has a special sort of way that being an agent has taught her how to read, which impacts this category, and then an upcoming release that she's excited about. Tell me about the first old book you love.
Attachments by Rainbow Rowell. I think I read Eleanor and Park in Galley because I really love her editor. And she was like, yes. And you know, if you like this, like she also did this other book on the adult side, and I know you do adult. And so I read Attachments and was so completely delighted by it. I love an epistolary novel. And so it really, really worked for me. And it's as much a friendship story as a romance. And it just had all of the things that I love in a like escape read.
I have not read Rainbow Rowell, but I just looked up the premise of this book and it's like my old job.
Yeah.
These two girls are friends in the workplace, and a coworker of theirs, his job is to monitor everybody in the office's email, which is a thing. And I used to work at an investment management firm, and per regulations, our email has to be monitored. And our direct manager read all of our email.
Oof.
Yeah. It wasn't even a guy like hidden, an IT guy that you never saw. It was your direct manager. So this guy ends up falling in love with one of the girls whose email he's monitoring.
It's such a great, is it creepier to say now? Or like there's like that tension of like how, you know, it's really lovely.
Can I tell you what I wrote in my notes?
What?
Cute, but also creepy, question mark.
Correct. And that tension is addressed. So fear not.
Good. I love it.
And then my other pick for this, and I'm trying to sort of like filter all of this through the lens of rom-com, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what this episode theme is going to be. Rom-com and Corona.
What a pair. So Anna and the French Kiss by Stephanie Perkins. It is, I would argue, a near perfect book. it's a debut, and I don't know how she did that. And it is just the sweetest, swooniest. It's set at a boarding school in Paris. And who among us has not wanted to go to a boarding school in Paris? The bar for a YA rom-com is so tricky, right? Because so to be a like a romance, like the rules of romance are that it has to end in a happily ever after, or at least a happy for now. So most YAs are reasonably go for happy for now, or you're like, I'm so happy they're together. Yay them. Anna and the French Kiss, you're like, no, this is it. I just watched someone find their forever person. And that is a really hard thing to do in a YA. I mean, I got married young. I'm from the South. It's kind of what we do. Still married. Points.
Congratulations.
So I am fundamentally perhaps more open to it than most readers. But I've heard even, you know, my like jaded New Yorker friends who were like, why would you ever get married before you're 35? Please. Even they were moved by this book. I think it's that these two characters connect so perfectly, and such care is given to the little moments between them that there's like a realism to it. I probably read it, if it came out in 2010, I probably read it in 2009 because it was very buzzy. Like, and it was a little bit of counter programming because it came out right in the middle at the time. YA was in this huge paranormal boom. So there was a lot of romance, but it was usually between like, it was the post Twilight years, like a girl and a vampire. But so this was sort of like counter programming. But this to me is a really great example of the form, and honestly something that people might have missed if they weren't reading YA in 2010, which, fair.
Right. And this is the first in a series, right?
Yeah, there's, I think, three more.
Are these same characters throughout the rest of the series, or is it different people?
Different main couple, like very classic romance construction, right? So it's like the best friend and then her romance.
Oh, okay, spin-off characters.
Uh-huh, spin-off characters. But your faves will pop up in the background, which is one of those things that's just so classic romance.
Jasmine Guillory did that, right?
Yes, it is a tried and true romance thing to be like, and then the brother gets a story. And it's one of the things I love like most wholeheartedly about like the genre. And it's applied to beautiful effect in this series.
All right, y'all, that was Anna and the French Kiss by Stephanie Perkins, first in a series. All right, tell me about the first new book you love.
So I am cheating a little bit by picking an agency title here, but I would be remiss to not, because it is legitimately just so fantastic. And that book is Love Lettering by Kate Claiborne, which is represented by my darling Taylor Haggerty, and was on like, I think just about every best of the month for December, which is when it came out. But it is genuinely so, so delightful. It has one of those just terrific premises where you're like, how has this book not existed before? It just feels so meant to be, which is a woman who is a hand lettering artist and has amassed this enviable following and business and has found herself just sort of bored with all of it. And to amuse herself, incorporates little design flourishes or aspects into her lettering work that are just sort of hidden messages to herself. And she gets this new client who's coming in to have his wedding invitations or wedding program done. And she does not think that this is a good choice for anyone involved. And so she sort of hides these little clues to herself for her own amusement about how this is not going to work. And then he turns back up on her doorstep wanting to know how she knew before he did that his marriage wasn't going to make it. And it is so good. There are many things about it that are terrific. And Kate's prior books are wonderful as well. But there's something about New York City as like small town.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that she gets in this way that like looking at the sort of chick lit forebears, there's the sort of glitz and gloss. And you know, city living. And I think one of the things that's so lovely in this is the sort of everybody knows your name, small town vibe, but in a big city.
And it's set in Park Slope, y'all, which is in Brooklyn. Compared to NYC, it is more of a small town feel in that part of NYC.
So I lived in New York before I was in California. When you have your home, it is just like anywhere else,
right,
while also being unlike anywhere else. And I just think that that is such a lovely setting. And so it gives you some of those, like, a lot of romance readers really love, like, the small town setting because it gives you that sort of everybody up in each other's business and these, like, long ties. And I just really loved the way that Kate showed that's a human thing. It's not exclusive to a zip code.
And in New York, you have your little neighborhood. You've got your neighborhood deli, your bodega, you've got your dry cleaner. And then there's a whole new set of those things five blocks down for a different neighborhood.
Yep.
That's interesting. I never really thought about that in that way, but that totally makes sense. All right. That was Love Lettering by Kate Claiborne. And that came out this past December. All right. Tell us about the second new book you love.
This shades a little bit more to the romance end of the rom-com. So if you were a Jasmine Guillory fan, I would recommend this. And it is The Worst Best Man by Mia Sosa. And listen, I'm not giving you deep tracks here, like also on a lot of best of lists. I had heard about it, but picked it up the last time I was in The Ripped Bodice, which is a romance-only bookstore in Los Angeles. I think it was maybe one of their book club picks. And this one I thought was so perfect because I enjoyed it as a reader, but I also really appreciated something that she did on a craft level. I'll give you sort of the like top level pitch. So it's enemies to lovers, which is a trope that you see in a lot of rom-coms, right? It sets up with this woman who's a wedding planner and was left at the altar. And the best man at her wedding is the one who comes and tells her, hey, it's not going to happen. And it turns out maybe like his brother, who her fiance who left, is like, thank you for making me able to make this choice. So somehow like sort of pins it on the best man that this was something that shouldn't happen. And then that ends up being the guy that she is in competition for a contract, like a job up against him. And so they're put back together and he is sort of the engine of her romantic downfall in the way that she sees it. And now also her competition for this job that would change her life. So with enemies to lovers, the hardship is that you have to both believe that they totally hate each other and also really want them to be together at the end. And that is a tightrope walk.
Yes.
Because you can really overshoot it in either direction. But I felt like this one walked such a good line. But I think that one of the things that's so cool about it, without, you know, doing spoilers, is that she sets up these little bits of like, it's just signposts to the reader where she's like, they were never meant to be together. Even as you're reading that she's devastated, you can feel the hand of the author being like, don't worry, I got you. And there's something really reassuring about that when you can see that the author is taking care of you. That as a reader, you're going on a journey and you're not on your own and the author knows where you're going and it's all going to be okay. So she just does this like really lovely signposting that even though things seem very bad, even though these people on paper, it sounds like there's no way you could ever possibly get them together. She drops these little breadcrumbs of character development and reveal that just really reinforce that like, you're going to be fine. You're going on a ride and it's going to be good. You're safe. You've got a seatbelt on.
This is also an Own Voices book. The author is Brazilian and like Brazilian culture comes into play through the course of the story, from what I understand.
Yes, it's this great immigrant family.
That was The Worst Best Man by Mia Sosa, and that came out in February. All right, let's talk about how you approach books you don't like and what being an agent has sort of taught you about reading those or not reading those.
So when you asked for a book I did not like, I had two thoughts, one of which was, well, I'm not going on the record about that. And the other of which was, well, okay, but the truth is there are really not a lot of books I hate. So as an agent, you're always reading things both as a reader, because presumably you got into this business because you like to read, but also as a job, as a business person. So you're constantly sort of filing away what worked, what didn't, what was good, what wasn't in every book that you read. So even when you read something that does not work for you as a reader, you're still sort of like, okay, but I see why people are talking about this. I see what people are connecting to in it. And so you sort of teach yourself out of hating things in this weird way.
Oh, interesting.
While also teaching yourself to just aggressively not finish books. Because you would never get through your submissions reading if you read every single page of every single thing ever. You know, sometimes you'll pick something, like you'll request a manuscript and it'll come in and you'll be like, oh, this is not my thing at all. And the longer you do this, the better you are at figuring out what's your thing. But when you sort of identify like what your nopes are, there's no value judgment associated with it. All you're reading for is like, am I the person to sell this? And so once you've sort of taken that step back already to be like, this book isn't bad, it's just not mine. it makes it a lot harder, even as like just a civilian reader, to summon real true disdain. I have way more books that I've read that I'm like, okay, meh, than I am strongly negative on.
What are some of your nopes?
I mean, I think for me, it is largely a voice thing. Like there are some voices that even if the story is kind of, I will just go with anywhere. I think I'm also very keenly aware of how mood and like moment in time impacts your read of things. There's an alchemy with books. And I think I'm so aware of that, that a lot of times it's easy for me to just be like, good for you. And maybe it will be there for me in the moment that my magic has aligned with it.
And I think that's extremely apt right now. I mean, my reading taste for this moment is not my average reading taste. And I'm sure that's true for lots of people. Let's talk about the upcoming release you're excited about.
This one I'm bending rom-com a little. It has rom-com clothes. And that book is Girl Gone Viral by Alicia Rye. I have not read it yet, but Alicia's books are always on the spicier end. And I don't know that anybody does it better. She's real great. But if that is not your cuppa, then this will not be your cuppa because it definitely is a spicier romance.
Okay. That's good to know.
But really well done. And really, to me, a great example, if you're curious about like in the best executed romances, you could not remove the sex scenes because what happens in those moments changes everything for the characters. And to me, this is a great example of that. It's not icing, it's the cake. Like you need all of it.
Right.
Again, I haven't read the new one, so I can't say.
This is the second in a series though, y'all. And you read the first one?
I did. And I don't think you would need to read the first one to read the second one.
Yeah, it looked like there were different characters.
Yes.
Which, as we now know, is a thing with romance.
Exactly. So I think it's the kind of thing where you could pick up with any of them and then figure out what you liked and then go back. But there's sort of these like modern love stories, right? So the idea being like ways that you would not, like 10 years ago, if you told someone this is how you met, they would look at you like you had three heads. And this one is sort of a, like, if you go viral in a way that you did not want to, what do you do with that? And the one before were these sort of rival app developers, like dating app developers, because she does both, you know, the wackiness of dating apps and like how terrible they are, and also the brain injury epidemic in Major League Football.
Oh, interesting.
Get you a book that can do both?
Yeah, that's an odd pairing, but I like it.
It totally works because, it's like all grounded in character.
Right.
I will buy whatever Alicia does, but in particular, very much looking forward to this because I know it will be great.
By the time this airs, this book is already out, so you can get it.
And then a little further down the road, we were talking before air about the sequel to The Royal We.
Yes.
The Air Affair. Yes, which I have pre-ordered despite completely being able to get a galley if I wanted one because I do not want one. I want to read it like a human and I cannot wait.
And y'all, I started The Air Affair last night. So by the time this airs, you will be able to have read my very preliminary and very high level thoughts on it on my blog. All right, let's play Rate It.
Okay.
I like to end every episode with this lightning round game called Rate It. And I will throw out five bookish things to you. And this, in some cases for you, could be related to your job. And you rate it either 1 or 5 stars.
Okay.
It's kind of like a love-hate thing. Just how you'd rate a book, but you cannot use 2, 3, or 4 stars. Number one, when a publisher goes rogue on a marketing plan for one of your books, because you had talked about how you don't necessarily have control, you have influence over things, but the final decision is not yours. If a publisher does something completely unexpected based on what you thought they were going to do with a marketing plan, how do you feel about that?
Well, usually that would only happen in a good direction. So I'm going to say 5 stars.
Okay.
I like a good surprise.
All right. Number two, the term chick lit.
Oh, that's divisive.
It is divisive.
For me personally, 5 stars because I am all about patriarchy smashing and refuse to shame things for being coded female. However, I understand that that is not a universal position. So if I'm looking at a marketing plan, probably 1 star. But for my heart, 5 stars.
Fair enough. And I feel like now with at least with rom-coms, people are just calling them rom-coms.
Yeah.
All right. Number three, I think I know how you're going to answer this based on something you said earlier. So working with a potential client in a quasi-editor capacity before you sign that client.
Oh, okay.
I know some other authors that have had this type of relationship with their agents. That's why I'm asking.
Paid, like the person pays you to be their editor, or you just send them notes before you sign them?
Right. And they go back and forth and make some changes to the book before the agent ever signs them as a client.
5 years ago, 5 stars. Right now, 1 star. I used to do a ton of this. My list is fuller now. So I would probably, if I felt like there was something there and I couldn't quite put my finger on it, I would probably, again, I just added a whole new suite of responsibilities when I opened the agency. So it's not like I'm like, oh, I'm too fancy to work.
You're not just an agent now, you're also a CEO.
Correct. So it's really just a bandwidth thing. I would probably hand off or tag team, like bring another agent in with me too. But I used to do a ton of these. They're called revise and resubmits.
Oh, okay. There's a name. Great.
Yeah. Where you like send notes to somebody and you're like, I would love to see this again. It's such a tenuous thing, I think, for both parties, because you are just like winging a prayer. And I know the authors feel a ton of pressure, but like we also do, because there's also the possibility that like someone else will just sign it and do the work with that person on their roster.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yep. That's risky.
You're both putting yourself out there in this very sweet way. I used to do it all the time. It also gives you a lot of information because you can find out if somebody can revise and whether they're sort of a surface reviser or whether they really go deep. And it's information too about how they hear you. Because if they can take, you know, with my current clients, I'll do a lot of like, you know, I'll send them a couple of points or like some questions, or we'll have a conversation. And then we've been working together long enough that they know how to take that and implement. And it sort of gives you a sense of whether you guys are connecting on a level that's going to allow someone to move into that same easy rapport over time. You know, somebody who can take one note that you gave them and then hear the note behind the note and be like, and okay, I'm also going to do this. Because when you asked me about this, I realized that that also impacts this. And you're like, oh yeah, you got this.
That makes sense though. All right. Number four, genre romance. And I don't know if I'm using the right term for that. Do you know what I mean by that?
I do. Yeah, I totally do. And that's totally a fine term to use. 5 stars. And let me tell you why.
Okay.
There is something for everyone. I don't love every kind of romance. I don't read every kind of romance. And the magical thing about romance is that that's great.
What's the big difference between a genre romance and a rom-com?
Frankly, marketing at the time.
Marketing. Okay.
You know, so some of the things that are marketed sort of as part of the rom-com trend aren't necessarily rom-coms. I mean, there's like we call some of the Brit imports, we call rom-sads internally at the agency. The Brits, I think, call them uplit, like the Eleanor Oliphants.
Oh, I wouldn't think that's a rom-com. That didn't feel rom-commy to me.
It's a really sad book, but it gets sort of included in a lot of the roundups. And I think it's just like accessible fiction by and for women. It somehow gets like clumped with rom-coms. I would not call that a rom-com either.
Yeah, I definitely didn't think that was a rom-com.
But like One Day in December, for example, is very divisive because she's with somebody else for a big chunk of it. And in a genre romance, you usually wouldn't see that.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. You don't have to like have sprung newly formed from the grass. You don't have to be a babe in the woods here, but you don't usually see another partner in the time that you're there.
Does that mean there's no love triangles?
Well, it doesn't mean there's no love triangles. You could have potential partners and be choosing between potential partners.
But you don't actually follow through.
Usually not. I mean, there's exceptions to every rule, but that is something that comes up a lot when we're talking about sort of like reader expectations and, you know, making sure that you're giving people what they want. And readers do love a love triangle, but that's usually a like, oh, will I pursue a relationship with this person or this person? Not, I'm already with this person and now there's this other. Which sometimes, again, sometimes can be a thing, but that's a little bit more specialized. I think there are nuances.
I feel like we could do a whole episode on the conventions of romance.
Well, honestly, I would tell you to go have Sarah McLean on because she teaches like what should really be a university course on the history of romance and how it is in conversation and dialogue with culture. That is the most fascinating thing you'll ever hear in your entire life. But yeah, I mean, I think with like the rom-com versus romance, so there's sort of not all rom-coms are romances, not all romances are rom-coms. Then you also have the extra hiccup of not all rom-coms are actually funny.
Right.
Which is like another piece of it. Not all romances are rom-coms. Not all rom-coms are romances. It is a little bit of the know it when you see it, right?
Like, I feel like for me, it's the cover will tell you. But maybe that's wrong.
This is actually an interesting thing. So one of the conversations that I've been having internally, like in the industry, is that right now, like because those covers are performing so well, there's this trend to sort of put most contemporary romances into that style. And there are some books out there that like you can jump right into like a, you know, 300 level, to use the college parlance, 300 level romance that's got this cutesy cartoon cover. And you're like, oh, okay.
I feel like that would be confusing for readers.
It is. So publishing does this all the time, right? We put something works, we jump on it, we kill it.
Yes. Like Gone Girl.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And so it's fine. Like if you're the ones that make it are going to make it, it'll be fine. But it is a bit of a killing the golden goose. And I think that you see that a little bit with packaging everything like a rom-com. But readers are pretty quick to tell other readers.
Yes.
So I actually think people being really like honest about like, didn't work for me, to whatever, is helpful signposting for other people. I have certainly read reviews that were not necessarily 5-star and thought, yes, this will be extremely my thing. Great.
Oh, absolutely. It's like the theory of having a reading anti-twin.
Yes, 100%. If this person hated it, I will love it. Yes, that totally happens. And more specifically, too, I think with like when you're playing with that genre thing, you know, you saw this some with Red, White, and Royal Blue, which people were like, it's YA. It is not YA.
Not YA. Uh-uh.
Not at all YA. So I do think like the packaging piece of it is where publishing sort of has the potential to screw things up by putting, you know, everything in this one look. But I do think that readers can tell.
Interesting. I'm learning so much talking to you. This is crazy. All right. Last one. This is, again, going to romance conventions. The expectation of happily ever after endings in romance. Do you like that is a thing or not?
5-star for me, but it actually doesn't matter because whatever I think or not, it isn't going anywhere.
Good to know.
That is the heart of what makes something a romance. That is a reader expectation that cannot be changed, should not be changed, arguably. And I think the whole rest of publishing is there for like a poignant, and then I wept at the end. So I am totally happy to have one category where I know that no women will be harmed in the making of this story. Or if they are, they will be redeemed by the end. And yeah, I'm here for it.
Man, I feel like I've learned so much today.
Oh, I'm so happy.
I feel like we could do a whole nother hour. We're not going to do that, but.
Well, I'll come back on some future date if I haven't blown everyone's mind with my hot takes about Edelweiss.
I would love that. All right, everybody, the April Superlatives episode for patrons will air at the end of the month, and it will include Holly's picks for categories like rom-com you'd most like to see made into a movie and worst publishing trend. And if you'd like to get this bonus episode plus other ones, you can support the show for $5 a month on Patreon. There's a link in the show notes and in my Instagram bio. Next week will be a mini episode featuring Liz Hine, and she's known on Instagram as LizHine89. And she is also a patron of the show. Talk to you next week. Thanks so much for listening to Sarah's Bookshelves Live. You can find show notes with all the books mentioned in the episode, purchase links, and linked timestamps at www.sarahsbookshelves.com/podcast. And that's Sarah with an H. I'd love to hear your comments, feedback, and suggestions. You can find me online on my blog, sarahsbookshelves.com, on Twitter at Sarah's Shelves, on Instagram at Sarah's Bookshelves, and via email at sarahsbookshelves@gmail.com. And if you'd like to get exclusive bonus episodes of the podcast, you can support us on Patreon at www.patreon.com/sarahsbookshelves. And there's a link in the show notes and in my Instagram bio to my Patreon page. Thanks for listening.